September 9th. Good afternoon, everybody. We're going to call to order the Energy Environmental Resources Committee meeting for Thursday, September 9th, 2021. Let's start with a roll call, please.
Agua Caliente. Blythe.
Let me see Joey.
He's unmuting.
Blythe is here.
Great. Cathedral City.
You got me.
Present.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coachella. Coachella Valley Water District. Desert Hot Springs.
Present.
Imperial Irrigation District. Indian Wells.
Present.
Indio.
Present.
La Quinta.
Present.
Mission Springs Water District.
Present.
Palm Desert.
Here.
Palm Springs.
Present.
Rancho Mirage.
Here.
Riverside County.
Here.
And I see that Agua Caliente has logged on.
Mm-hmm.
We have a quorum.
Great. Thank you very much, Tricia. And before we get started, I'd like to go ahead and introduce Jody Ross Borrego, who is our new Director of Environmental Resources. So we bid our farewell to Katie, although she's not completely out of the picture. But Jody, I'd like to go ahead and give you an opportunity to introduce yourself and give us a little bit about your background, since you'll be our new person in this group and in other areas of CVAG. So welcome.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. She said my name, Jody Ross Borrego. I'm very happy to be here. I have quite some large shoes to fill with Katie's departure. So it's been an interesting first couple weeks. This is my first full week. So still working with Katie a little bit and thankful she's staying on. My previous life, I was in consulting. I've been in the Valley for about 15 years, living in the Valley, working in the Valley for about 17 years, doing consulting, biology specifically. And I have had the opportunity to work with Katie for years on various different JPRs. And I'm happy to be here. And it's nice to meet all of you.
How do you feel about bighorn sheep? That's a loaded question. We're happy to have you here.
The fence is almost up.
Well, welcome. Appreciate that. Let's move to our public comments on, I'm going to say, agenda or non-agenda items if we have any requests to speak. Tricia, do we have any? Is Randy commenting?
Did not receive any emailed comments, and I do not see any hands raised at this time.
Okay, good deal. All right, committee members and director comments. I know that we've heard from Jody already. Other committee member comments. I know Oscar usually gives us an update.
Yes, I do have an update from last week's SCAG meeting for the Energy Environment Committee. We had one public comment from the Climate Center in Santa Rosa, who are currently pushing to get California to carbon negative by 2030 to align with the needs stated in recent science publications. They're also advocating for secure transition for workers and climate justice through inclusion and equity. We had a presentation from the Luskin Center at UCLA where they talked about a publication they're working on that documents the climate change impacts on vulnerable communities, such as impacts of extreme heat on worker health and safety, impacts of extreme heat on infant health, impacts of extreme heat on household financial burdens, and impacts on manufactured housing and subsidized housing. I did mention some of the issues we saw here in the Eastern Coachella Valley after our recent storm took out the power for hundreds of North Shore residents, many who live in manufactured homes and extreme heat conditions. We also had a representative from the California Air Resources Board where they discussed how our cap and trade dollars are being used for state projects throughout the state using our greenhouse gas reduction fund. So far, $15 billion has been appropriated and $9 billion has been implemented. 659,000 acres of land has been preserved or restored. 8,000 units of affordable housing are under construction. Over 740 transit agency projects have been funded. Over 400,000 rebates for zero emission and hybrid vehicles have been given out. And over 125,000 urban trees have been planted Statewide, we have 51% of this funding going to priority populations. And in our region, 78% of this funding is going to priority populations. And that's all I have for the update. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Oscar. Questions for him? No, any other director comments, member comments?
Oscar, I'm waiting on my Tesla wall and my new Mustang. Could you get to work on that?
We're working on it. Maybe next month.
All right, very good. We'll move on to item number 5, and that would be our consent calendar. We've got 4 items, which includes the minutes and some agreements that hopefully you've had a chance to review. Any questions or comments on the consent calendar items? Otherwise, I'll entertain a motion.
Madam Chair,
Let's question Russell.
Yeah, thank you. Could we get item B pulled for just a brief staff report or explanation?
Sure. Who wants to take this one? Ben's coming on board. Great.
Greetings.
Hello.
Did you want me to just go through the staff report, or did you have specific questions?
If you could just do a quick overview, and then we'll maybe go from there if I have more questions.
Okay, 1 second.
And this would be the dividend financial.
Okay, yes.
Or the PACE program and with CVAG oversight.
So it's been a while since we've had a new PACE provider approach us. This agreement I've been working on for a few months with Dividend to finally get it sent through the committees. If you recall, on one of the past staff reports I did, the HERO program went bankrupt. The Renovate America went bankrupt. So we no longer have HERO services for residential customers in our area. Dividend approached us. They are interested in working in the Coachella Valley, but only as a commercial provider. And they have agreed to the terms of our agreement, which provides CBAG oversight. And that's pretty much the gist of this PACE provider.
Good. So I just prompted 2 questions, Madam Chair.
Please.
Commercial provider, what does that mean? They don't do residential?
They don't do residential. They'll only be focusing on commercial projects.
Okay, well, that would negate my second question. What's the interest rate? I'm sure a commercial provider is able to sort that out for themselves. With some of the other programs, interest rate has been so high that I felt like we've sent sharks in on our residents because they've been getting such high interest rates in the past program. So, okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And Tricia, if you can note for the record, we've got Supervisor Hewitt, District 5, has joined us. Thank you. Okay, so let's go back to entertaining a motion for the 4 consent items.
Make a motion to accept.
That would be Rancho Mirage.
And I'll second the motion.
And Palm Desert will second the motion. Great. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? All right, no opposition, no abstention. So I'll consider that motion unanimously approved. Wonderful. And section 6, discussion action, this is going to be and that is number A, which is understanding impact in the Coachella Valley, and our good partner, Dr. Cameron Barrows from UC Riverside Center of Conservation Biology, is going to give us a brief update on climate change. All right, that's shared screen. I'm sure I'm going to go ahead and go on mute while you do your thing, Cam.
Well, thank you, Mayor Evans, very much. And I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you all about a very important topic. I'm going to share my screen here. And there we go. Oops, let me go back here. So, this is a very complicated topic, and I'm given very few minutes to talk to you about it. I'll do my best. Maybe if you have questions or if there's an opportunity for me to come back in sometime in the future, I'd be happy to talk to you again about it. I think we all live here and we all know that it's getting hot. It's the desert sun always documents every time we've broken another record, and we continue to break records every year, and places around the country are breaking records every year, places around the world. So what I wanted to show you here is, rather than just these newspaper headlines, and show you the real data so you can look at it for yourself. And so these are temperature data that are collected from one of the fire stations in Indio. And this is one of the longest records of temperature that we have for the Coachella Valley. It goes back to almost 1900. And the thing that I want to show you here is that if you start out back in the 1900s, the average January temperatures, and so this is both highs and lows averaged together, was about 54 degrees Fahrenheit. And it continues to be about that average until about 1980. And then something changes. So this, I think a lot of times I'll hear people say, well, it's always been hotter, it's always been this, and this isn't any different than any time in the past. But these data really show something that's very different. There's a trend here. And if you look at the average, about 54 going to about 1980, and then take it today, and that average is closer to 60 degrees. And so we're looking at a 6 degree Fahrenheit, or a roughly three degree centigrade change increase in our winter temperatures. You do the same thing with summer temperatures, you get a very similar thing. We can see that our average for so many years has been around 92. Again, that's averaging both the low and the high temperatures. But now it's quite a bit different than that. We're going all the way up to 96 degrees. So now we're dealing with a 4 degree difference in hot temperatures in this Fahrenheit, which is about a 2 degree difference centigrade. So the difference is not exactly the same between winter and summer. The winter temperatures are getting hotter faster. And I think that's going to be an important point later on in my talk. So try to remember that point. It's not just us, the entire world is getting warmer. So any of this on this map, anything that looks pink or red is hotter than average. And if you look at where we are, it's much hotter than average. The entire southwestern United States is much hotter than average. So is the eastern part. There's a portion in the center of the United States that's just a little bit more than average. But as you can see, there's very few places on this map that are blue, which would be cooler than average. And if you were expecting this to be something that was back in the 1960s or before, you should see a balance of red, white, and blue in here. And we're not seeing that. It's dominated by red, which is, again, this overwhelming warming condition. But the real question here, and I think the question that all of us should be asking ourselves, is this something that is a normal pattern that we can't do anything about? Or is it something that humans have had their hands on? And this is really the controversial point that a lot of people wrestle with. And so I wanted to give you some information here just to give you some ideas. First thing I wanted to show you is that this idea that carbon dioxide has been warming the atmosphere isn't anything new. Eunice Foote, somebody you've undoubtedly heard of, actually, nobody's ever heard of her practically, but she was the first scientist to figure out that carbon dioxide was actually different in the atmosphere than just oxygen or any of the other chemicals out there. And she put together these cylinders filled with both oxygen and carbon dioxide and put thermometers in them. And what she found when she put them in the sunshine, the carbon dioxide warmed faster, that cylinder warmed faster. And then when she took them out of the sun and left them in the cool environment, they stayed warmer much, much longer than the oxygen did. And so she was able to show that in 1856. So this isn't a bunch of researchers trying to make their name today. This is something that happened a long time ago. And Eunice was the very first person to do this. And it's noteworthy because back in her day, women were not generally accepted in the scientific community. And so she was out on her own doing these things. And I think she would have been a force to deal with if she was living today, I'll tell you. later, 40 years later, a Swedish fellow named Svante Arrhenius stood on Eunice's shoulders and said, well, let's look at this a little bit more. And I don't even think he acknowledged her because science was still a boys' club back then. But what he tried to figure out is looking at the math and saying, what happens if CO2 or carbon dioxide increases? What does that mean to the temperature of the atmosphere? And what he came up with was this mathematical relationship that I'm going to show you in just a second here, that if carbon increases geometrically, then we should see temperature increase arithmetically. So let's look at some graphs that show you that. And so the one on the left here is carbon dioxide. And you can see that if you go all the way back to the beginning of civilization, carbon dioxide in our atmosphere was more or less stable during that entire period until about 1800, and then something changes, and it changes dramatically. So when I have a group of students in my class, and I teach a couple of different classes, one of which is called Climate Stewards. And I always ask the students, so what happened in the year 1800 or so thereabouts that would have made a difference there? I never have had a class that got it wrong. They always get it right. That's the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And so from that point, carbon dioxide grew very rapidly. And in fact, this is an old graph, and it would be up here around 410 parts per million if we were to have a current graph. But this kind of graph, this J shape, is what we call a geometric progression. So what Arrhenius said is if we get a geometric progression, then we should see an arithmetic progression with respect to temperature. So the graph on the right is temperature. And you can see that temperature was stable for the longest time until about 1980 or so. And then there's been this increase. And when you see a straight line, not a J shape like I showed you before, that's arithmetic relationship. So both Eunice and Svante were exactly correct in their projections of what should happen if carbon dioxide increases in the atmosphere. So now we're going to take it to a couple other graphs. These are graphs that were developed by NASA about 6 years ago. And with this controversy as to what's happening and why is it happening, they decided, rather than getting a bunch of scientists to say, this is the answer, they made the data public. They said, here, figure it out for yourself. And one of their graphs gave us was that they showed carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that goes back almost a half a million years. And when you look at this, you can say this rise and fall of carbon dioxide, even before the Industrial Revolution. These low points are ice ages. The high points are the warming periods in between the ice ages. And you can see there's been several ice ages in the last half a million years ago. And there's been several warming periods. We just emerged from an ice age about 20,000 years ago, and we're going into this warming period. But now the carbon dioxide is higher than it's ever been before. Again, remember, about 410 parts per million is the current measurements for that. So carbon dioxide has always fluctuated, but it's fluctuated in a very predictable way that is associated with orbital shifts. When we get closer to the sun, we get out of an ice age and we get more plants and more decomposition, and there's more carbon dioxide. When we're away from the sun, we go into an ice age, there's less plants and less carbon dioxide. So this cycle is very predictable and very regular, but what's happening now is different. So this NASA folks said, well, let's look at what could be causing this. And so they said, okay, here's the temperature rise, and don't worry about the what the temperatures are here. It's basically each one of these lines is about a quarter of a degree centigrade. And you can see that it's definitely rising, and it's definitely been rising more and since about 1980 than any other time. So they said, well, what if it's just a natural thing like volcanic activity? Could that explain it? And there is a relationship, especially if you go back around 1900, there's a very close relationship, but currently there's no relationship between volcanic activity and temperature rise. So they said, well, let's look at a bunch of other things. So they said, well, what about just natural conditions, and that's mostly volcanic activity or land use, and orbital changes like has been the cause in the past, or solar flares, and again, the volcanic activity. None of them explain this rise. They all are just sort of fluctuating around a constant level. So that doesn't help very much. So they said, what about aerosol sprays? So we'll go up to the top right here and say, well, could that be it? And for those that are my age or older, you'll remember that we banned most aerosol sprays because that we were worried about the ozone layer. And so people who had hairspray or underarm deodorants that were in spray cans, you can't get that anymore, or you get them in different forms. And so they said, well, what's happening with aerosols? Well, actually, they're going down in the atmosphere, and that's actually a really good thing. That means that by banning aerosol sprays, we've made a huge difference. And ozone, which is what we were worried about at the time, has rebounded. And so you can see just a very slight increase in ozone, but again, it doesn't explain the temperature. So that doesn't help us very much. So what if we think about greenhouse gases? And those include things that we've produced, but also lots of naturally occurring greenhouse gases. Methane is one, and carbon dioxide is another, and there's quite a few others. And all of a sudden, there's a relationship. There's something that's actually pretty close. And so greenhouse gases seem to be the best explanation for that. But then if you then say, well, let's look at human-caused greenhouse gases. And that's the only thing we're going to look at here. So let's start with the temperature, and you get a really close relationship. So this is a correlation, but it's a very good correlation. And none of the other forcings or things that could be causing this that NASA scientists were able to think of, and they tried their best to come up with everything people were postulating, that it had nothing to do with humans. This is a natural cycle. This is all of these various things. None of that's true when you look at the data. So we've got this condition of warming. And so what do people in the United States think about that? And so this is a map that's created by Yale University. And they come up with these maps every couple of years just to basically take the temperature of the human perceptions of what's going on. And so this is how many people think that global warming is actually happening? And they came up with 72%. There's a few counties where there is dissent. There's one here in the what they call the Permian Basin of Texas, and one near there. And there's a couple in the coal mining zone up here in West Virginia and Kentucky. But otherwise, it's pretty unanimous, at least more than 50%, that people believe climate change is happening. And the data supports that. So that makes sense. Do you think that climate change is going to harm plants and animals? And again, there's pretty good agreement on this. One of the interesting things to me here is that Imperial County is always very strong in their opinion on this. So are the coastal areas of California. Riverside County is pretty good, but you can see this lighter area sort of in the middle of the country that's more than 50%, but not much over 50%. Then the question is, do you think global warming is going to harm future generations? And again, the same patterns that you've seen before. Imperial County is very strong again. Sort of these counties down in South Texas, away from the oil producing areas. So the country, by and large, believes that climate change is happening, that it's going to harm plants and animals, it's going to harm future generations. Yet it's really not on the political agenda to do anything about it. And so why would that be the case? So the next question they asked is, well, is it going to hurt you personally? And blue means they don't think so. And so even though they think it's going to hurt their grandchildren, they don't think it's going to hurt them. And so it's not on the their in front of their face saying we should do something, even though we had Superstorm Sandy over here and all the flooding and the hurricanes in here and the ocean rising in Miami. I've got a friend who has a favorite bar in Miami, and he said in the last few years, at high tide, water comes into the floor in the bar every high tide, and they're walking in 2 inches of seawater, and then it goes away at low tide. And And that's only going to get worse as things go on. And then in, here in the West, we have wildfires and we have droughts that are going on and on and on. Yet nobody thinks it's happening to them, and it's not happening to them now. This is a real disconnect, and it's an interesting one. You can explain it a little bit in this idea of creating or misrepresenting the science. This is a scientist, this fellow named Mari Hoffert, who did work for Exxon. Exxon used to have a whole stable full of top-ranked scientists, and they wanted to figure out what was going on with the climate. They wanted to figure out all sorts of things. And when Marty here said, well, wait a minute, it looks like it's going to have a really negative impact on people. Exxon's chief executive at the time, Lee Raymond, his public response to that was, well, we don't really know what's going on. And there's not a lot of conclusive evidence. So we think we should just go on with business as usual. And that's basically the information people have come up with to do nothing. I'm going to change gears just a little bit here, but I think this is, I wanted to point out these very rare photographs that I have of the Coachella Valley about 20,000 years ago. And you can see in the Coachella Valley, we were in the middle of an ice age. The ice never reached even close to the Coachella Valley, but it was cooler and wetter. And we had camels and we had horses and we had mastodons and mammoths and we had saber-toothed cats. It would have been a really interesting place to live and probably a pretty scary place to live. But it was probably just at the verge when the first indigenous people were coming to North America and coming into the Coachella Valley. And so they got a chance to see this. It got warmer after that. Again, we remember those orbital cycles that caused the ice ages and then the warming. And we were now in a warming period. So as that happened, we changed back to a desert. There was this fluctuation from wet and cool to warm and dry, and that happened over and over again, and we went back to a desert condition. So one of the things that my research team is looking at is to try to figure out what's going on with our desert today. We've got a whole group of volunteers. All of them are residents of the Coachella Valley. They look like a bunch of bandits out there, but we're doing this in the middle of the pandemic, and we're trying to keep everybody as safe as possible, and we're trying to measure what's happening in our environment and then what kind of changes are happening because of the warming that has happened so far. Some of what we do is up in Joshua Tree National Park, and we're measuring the trees. And from that information, we're coming up with scientific models. And this is a model, a map that is derived from the model that shows the distribution of Joshua trees within the park today. So the boundary is the park, and then there's this sort of buffer around the park that we're showing you there. And everything that's green is where you can find a Joshua tree today. And so with the models, what you can do then is sort of change the temperature variable and say, well, what happens if it gets a little bit warmer? And so scientists who study the climate say, if we get serious about climate right now, it's still going to continue to be warming, but we'll be able to change things fairly within a few decades and get it back to what we all grew up considering normal. So if we act right now, what's going to happen? And that's the loss of Joshua trees. So we'll be down about to one quarter of the current existence of Joshua trees out there. What happens if we wait a little bit? Let's wait another 5 or 6 years and then get serious about it. It drops even further. But what's really shocking here is if we decide, you know, it's not our problem. We're going to be gone before it gets that bad, and we'll let our grandchildren deal with it. If we do it that way, we lose all the Joshua trees, and not just in the park, but everywhere. There, it's a very sensitive species, and it's one of the reasons Joshua trees have been proposed by the state to be an endangered species. These are models, and all models are a little bit wrong, but what we found is we go out and we're measuring where the baby Joshua trees are. And that's an indication that the Joshua trees are happy, that they're still recruiting, they're replacing the natural mortality that occurs there. The only place that we are finding baby Joshua trees coming in is in that area that I showed you that is, we need to do, if we do something right now, that's about one quarter of the Joshua trees will still be there. Within that mapped area are the only places that we're seeing baby Joshua trees. outside of that area, there's plenty of ash trees, but there's no babies. There's no recruitment happening. There's no regeneration happening. It's not all bad news. In this landscape, both in Joshua Tree and around our neck of the woods down here in the lower desert, there are these things called climate refugia, places that are cooler and wetter than the surrounding landscape. And what we find that plants and animals that would have been at low elevations during that last ice age are still at low elevations in these little niches. And we find them up in the Indian Canyons. They're part of the Agua Caliente Reservation. We find them in a lot of the palm oasis areas. This little inset is a fence lizard that we only in the Coachella Valley find really above 3,500 to 4,000 feet. But here at an elevation as low as just about 1,000 feet, we're finding them. And that's a climate refugia. It's staying cooler and wetter, even though that it's getting hotter and drier all around. It's buffering against that change. So even though things are changing elsewhere within these climate refugia, they're changing much slower. And that gives us a chance to actually do something without massive extinctions. So sometimes you'll hear in the news about these massive extinctions. It could happen, but right now these climate refugia are making a difference. We're also looking at just the hillsides. This is the one on the left is a hillside in the La Quinta area. Compare that at the same elevation, the same conditions in the Palm Springs area. Huge difference. It's wetter and cooler, especially wetter in the Palm Springs area. They have twice as much rainfall as we do in the La Quinta area where I live. And what you see is a very different world. We have, again, our volunteers. This was before the pandemic. We go out, we measure these things every year and say, what's happening? What's changing? What we're finding, and this is on the Bear Creek Trail, these are brittle bushes. I'm just circling the live ones on this slope. These are the dead ones. It's 79% of them are dead on this slope. Even the Ocotillo, if we look at the live ones, there's a bunch of them that are dead. There's no recruitment happening on this slope at all. We're just losing adults as they age out of the system, but we're not getting any young ones coming back. The good news is, however, if you go to a higher elevation, we're just a little bit higher here, the brittle bush is doing much, much better. You can see lots and lots of live ones. There's still a lot of dead ones in there, but it's only 49 or 42%. And all of the Ocotillo are healthy. And so this is, at this elevation, it's acting like a climate refugia. And if you go further up the slope, it's even better. There's virtually no mortality in any of the plants as you go up just a few more hundred meters. So that's good news that there are places, even in the La Quinta slopes, the driest, hottest area of the Coachella Valley, that are doing great. However, as you can imagine, if we're losing the plants, there's nothing for animals to eat. And so at these lower elevations and at the hotter, drier end of the Coachella Valley, eventually we won't have habitat left for bighorn sheep, except for the golf courses, of course. But at the same time, I think we need to think about this in human terms and economic terms. And as you all know this very well, the Palm Springs Coachella Valley Visitors Bureau has determined that hiking is the primary thing people are doing when they come to the Coachella Valley. And if they're hiking and it's just a barren slope and there's nothing going on there, I don't think it's gonna be nearly as popular as the chance to see a bighorn sheep or a chuckawalla or any of the other plants. And so that could go away as well. So what about people? I was reminding you to think about the winter temperatures getting warmer faster. One of the consequences of that is that we're getting new species of mosquitoes that are showing up that otherwise would die during a colder winter. This particular mosquito that I'm showing you here is the primary carrier of a lot of different diseases. And the only one that we get right now is West Nile, and West Nile is definitely on the increase in our region and throughout the arid parts of the United States. But these other diseases are right there, or could be right there. All we need is a human to have the disease, move into the Coachella Valley while they still have an active disease, get bit by that particular mosquito, and that would move it to everybody else that mosquito would be biting and so forth. So that's an issue that we are worried about. as we get these 120 degrees, which are becoming more and more common, the summer is extending into what we used to think was the cooler spring and the cooler fall more and more. The question then is, what happens to the Coachella Valley in terms of the visitors? Are we going to have people that want to live here if that's the way the future looks like? And if we have people that are going to want to live, not want to live here or not want to visit here, what does that mean to our economy? What happens to tourism? What happens to the second home economy that is so much a part of the prosperity that we currently have in the Coachella Valley? Then we're going to have higher energy costs, and water is going to be an issue. And you probably have read about it, but they're talking about the Colorado River drying up or getting to the point where it's not going to be supplying water to people in the not too distant future. Not every year, but in certain years. And if we can't depend on it as a source of replenishing our aquifer, what does that mean to the Coachella Valley? So, and elsewhere, people are dealing with flooding and hurricanes and wildfire. So and the point I'm trying to drive home, it's not a problem for future generations. This is something that's happening now. The other part that's really important is to understand that it's the effect is uneven across the human communities that we have here in the Coachella Valley or anywhere. So folks that are lower income will suffer the most from climate change. And this is important because they don't have the financial resources or the resilient accesses to, you know, to make things better. For most of us on the phone, you know, we could probably afford to pay for more air conditioning or pay for more water or pay for a lot of things and be able to get by just fine. But for a lot of folks, that's not the way it's going to be for them. Their participation in the economy is essential, and so we can't discount them, and they are a very important part of what makes the Coachella Valley so successful. So these are things that we just, I think, should be thinking about. So can we, or what should we do? And I think this is where we could talk for a couple of hours, because there's a lot of things we could do, but there was a recent quiz that you could take online, and it's still available. And I took the quiz, and I'll let you know that I got an 86, which was very important because I teach the class. I should be getting a pretty good grade on this, but most people get what basically below 50% in this. And so the quiz is basically trying to take lots and lots of things that you might do and figure out what the impact might be on a global scale. So we're not just talking about the Coachella Valley or even the United States, we're talking about a global scale. And the biggest thing we could do globally is manage the chemicals that are used in refrigeration. Those leaking into the atmosphere are, if we could stop that, that's the equivalent of getting 673 million cars out of their pollution equivalent away. If we could install more wind turbines, that's, again, globally, not just the Coachella Valley, that's almost the same amount. If we could cut down on food waste, and this is where it really is important and interesting to think about. Food waste is a huge, huge contributor to climate change. We could, again, a similar number, take and get rid of the effluents, the carbon dioxide going up there. Eat more plants, a little bit less meat. You don't have to be a vegan, but just start cutting things down. Oops.
The sign, Cam.
Pardon me?
I said that's a sign.
Yeah, this is the last slide.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
And so anyway, I just wanted to point out that there's lots of things we could do. And the interesting thing to me is that none of them require a change in technology. None of them require a change in our culture. None of them require anything differently other than a will to make the difference. Using water more efficiently, things like that make a huge, huge difference. And I just wanted to compliment, the Coachella Valley isn't actually doing very well with the windmills, the solar, we're doing really quite well. There are cities like Palm Springs in particular that have cut their greenhouse gas emissions up hugely. and done it without relatively painlessly. And a lot of the cities, including the city I live in, La Quinta, are working towards creating walkable communities where we don't have to drive everywhere we go. And I think all of those are positive, including CB Link, things like that. These are all very positive things we can do. Obviously, there's more we can do, but I think that the Coachella Valley, it wouldn't hurt your arm by patting ourselves on the back, but we're on the right path and we just need to continue on that path. And that's where I'm going to stop the share. And thank you very much for letting me speak to you.
Great. Thank you. As always, very informative. And it looks like Russell has a question for you. Go ahead, Russell.
I'll save my second question. My first one is, with the sea level rise, do you think there's a chance that we might get the Salton Sea to fill back up?
If we do absolutely nothing forever, yes. I mean, the sea level would have to rise over 100 feet for it to get over the hump that it would need to get in there. But okay, well, I know that was in jest, but it's an interesting idea.
There may be hope for that initiative then. Thank you.
Great. Supervisor Perez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for that presentation, Dr. Barrows. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate the point that you made around environmental justice and, quite frankly, underserved communities. Just recently, there was maybe a workshop and even some sort of video documentary that was put out, I think by folks from UC Riverside, I'm not exactly sure who it was, that talked about climate change and how they impact communities of color, the more impoverished areas. And so I wanted to ask you, you know, you brought up some points at the end there about what we can do more, but I'm wondering what these impoverished communities can do as well, and where the cultural competency maybe comes in. Because I think that this type of conversation is fairly new to a lot of people, but the climate change piece and linking it to poverty and linking it to communities of color, that's really new. And so I'm wondering what we can do to educate folks in these communities and then, quite frankly, as well, what they can do so that we can see change there in those communities. And I also had the question around how is this going to impact the Salton Sea? That maybe is another conversation.
Let's leave the Salton Sea to a different conversation. But I think your point about environmental justice is extremely important. And when I was showing in those maps of the United States, I kept pointing out how Imperial County shows up as much more aware of climate issues than surrounding areas. We all know who lives in Imperial County. We're talking about people who are more impoverished for the most part and are living, you know, right there with the land as farmers and so forth and so on. So I think that for the most part, we're talking about people that are already aware that this is a problem, but they feel they're powerless essentially to do anything about it. And I think that there's a lot that we can do. I know CBAG is beginning an initiative to talk about greening neighborhoods and planting trees. Trees both collect carbon dioxide, which is helpful, but they also shade streets and they shade houses, and that will make a huge difference. Programs to upgrade air conditioning systems to make sure that they have the ability to cool themselves, which currently many of them don't have. I think Oscar was talking about the power outage that happened in the East Valley just a week or two ago, and how so many people were without power. Can you imagine when it's 110, 115, 120 degrees and not have access to air conditioning? And those people were feeling it right up front when that was happening. So it's a very important issue. I think we collectively need to work towards helping that end of the valley and those impoverished people to become climate resilient. And there's lots of things we can do, but those are just starting points.
Just very quickly, Madam Chair.
Sure.
Dr. Barrows, I'm going to follow up with you. I'd like to have this conversation, a longer conversation with you. And then quite frankly, even with the AQMD board, I think this conversation needs to be had at that level as well. And within the AB 617 communities that exist, we have one here in Eastern Coachella Valley, but we have them throughout the AQMD area in Southern California. And I think potentially this can be very helpful to everybody. Thank you, Dr. Barros.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Okay, Oscar, I see any hand up.
Yes, just very quickly. First of all, just thank you for the presentation and, you know, just the historical perspective on that. I think that's very helpful for us. And I think one of the things I wanted to ask of staff, I know that we had some booklets that we were working on for guides for cities on different, you know, plants that we could use, different methods that we could use to reduce our impacts. So do we have any updates on those two workbooks that we had coming along?
Anyone?
I can comment on that because I'm working with Katie. We are working on finalizing that urban greening guide, as well as the story map that our fellow had put together. So as soon as they're ready, we can share them with the group.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much.
So I just had a quick kind of question from the crowd listening afar, how Desertscape reduces use of the water, but potentially could add to the heat index.
I think that that's probably a misunderstanding of Desertscape. I think we can use trees, we can use Palo Verdes, we can use ironwoods, we can use a lot of things. We need to use trees to, mosquitoes and other species, to shade our buildings, to shade our highways, to shade our walkways. But we need plants that are using less water. And so you can plant a ficus, which is very commonly used, or tamarisk, which used to be commonly used, and they're water hogs. Unfortunately, palm trees are water hogs, and they don't provide any shade at all. And so there are plants that we can use that are both water thrifty and provide the shade that we need. The nice thing about Desertscape, if it's done right, you can also provide habitat for animals. And so even the plant animals that are really hurting on our lower desert slopes are actually thriving in my yard because I've got a Desertscape yard and they're doing great.
Okay. Oscar, did you have another question or just have your hand up? We got to get going on the next agenda items.
Just adding on to that, that's okay. Why I'm so eager for the guides is to see, you know, as we propose, as we try to convince our residents to go into Desertscape, how do we propose that in an even more responsible way, right? Getting the right plants that are gonna be able to habitat our local wildlife, getting the right plants that are gonna be able to provide shade and cooling for our homes, and just do this all in a much, just a smarter way, right? Taking it to the next level and really planning out our communities for our wildlife and for our families, right?
Excellent point.
And Nancy's got her hand up.
Is there a way for us to share this PowerPoint?
Well, I know it was recorded and you're happy to, if CBAG is willing.
Permission, right. Permission granted, Dr. Barros?
Yes.
Thank you.
Permission granted. Actually, I'd like a copy of it too. I get a lot of requests to do speaking and I more than I can usually do. So it'd be nice to be able to just hand something over to somebody and say, here, watch this.
Great. Tricia?
I just wanted to announce for the record that Councilmember Galarza of Coachella joined us during that item.
I did see that. Thank you. Okay, again, thank you, Dr. Barros. Always very informative. And I know at some point we're going to keep you in that time limit, but listen, we love the discussion and it's always worth the extra time. So thank you very much for that. I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay. We do have another update. I know that Oscar had mentioned it briefly, but I had asked Tom to get somebody from IID to provide us an update on the North Shore weather events and the power outages. And I believe Marilyn Gilbert has just logged in for a brief update on the status. Go ahead, Marilyn. We do see you shared screen. We just can't hear you.
Okay, there we go. Can you hear me now?
Yes, yes.
Good afternoon, panelists. Do I need to share my screen? I thought this was going to be run for me, but I will be glad to do so.
No, it's if you want to just say next slide, that would work. We've got it covered here.
Okay. Thank you so much. So Dr. Barros, thank you so much for joining us here. And this is actually very timely on the, some of the phenomena that we're experiencing within this, the Coachella Valley, as well as Imperial Valley. And as we're seeing some climate change, we actually noticed that we're getting some storm effects or wind tunneling or microbursts in throughout the community that has changed now the design parameters and why some of the, it's affecting us here in the power industry and have to make, build more resilient systems for us. So I just want to start with a little bit of background and I'll be brief and quick. We had two events back to back. One of them occurred on August the 30th and the second occurred on August 31st of last week. The first one impacted the North Shore area and that outage first occurred on 7:30 p.m. And then we had, as we were declaring our declaration for the August 30th event for the Coachella Valley, while in Imperial Valley, then we started getting multiple locations in both Imperial and Valley and Coachella Valley being impacted, and the Calpatria area was impacted the most, and the first outage occurred at 4:42 p.m. In less than 24 hours, IID lost over 145 transmission and distribution poles. Next slide. So this outage map here gives you the location in the North Shore, and it was a line that is, we call the K line, that is located a transmission line, and it is one of importance for this community because underneath there, there's an underbuilt that actually services the community, and that's the circuit that provides energy to all of the homes there. About 2,690 customers were affected by this outage. And we were able to restore the majority of the customers during the outage by alternate feeds. And that's what the systems typically do, is that they provide different ways. But we knew then that certain parts of our customers that section was not going to be able to be restored in a timely, efficient manner. And we were already projecting that the outage was going to last about 4 days. Next slide, please. So I'd want to give a little bit more about what we experience when we have a storm restoration process. And this is what this slide here talks about. We have, we first get our notifications, and in this case, we had outage calls that affected the area on in the Coachella Valley. We received 227, and then the next day, we had 950 calls. Immediately after the storm and during the storms, we tend to have our, what we call our troubleshooters, the individuals that are assessing, but at the same time, if they see repairs, they typically, you know, restore the system if it didn't switch automatically. And sometimes you see a little blink that happens, and that something happened, that means we lost the feed or we lost the circuit, we lost the breaker, and the system did what it was supposed to do. And in ideal conditions, that happens and everybody doesn't see, and we're still working behind the scenes on different restorations, but the public still has all of their lines. So we identify, isolate, and determine what the estimated time of restoration, and we're giving here the North Shore expansion. We already said it's going to take between one and nine days, depending where the damage is at. And then we have to coordinate the restoration of the prioritization to ensure that we restore the most customer at once. We will work through engineering to ensure that what we rebuild is going to be property engineered. And then we also ensure that we have the right materials, deploy crews, support staff. And then at that point, we also engage the community and community partners in communication. So we all continue to work. It's not just the people that are in the field, but there's a lot of back support offices that happen here. And in the case of here is we're dealing with one storm restoration when another one rolled in, and we knew then at that point that all of our crews were going to be impacted, and that's when we had to bring in mutual aid. And I'll talk a little bit more what mutual aid was brought in a subsequent slide. And then at the end, we closure event debriefing, what went on, what went right, what can we do better. And then we also look potentially to apply federal assistance and funds, you know, when the storm-related events occur. Next slide. This is just a high-level event of the timeline to give us what we have, the storm date when it occurred, the emergency declaration was the next day, the command center was restored. We have our contract crews arrive when we had to pull resources from one source of the valley, so now we're dealing with a different impact to the other one, and we also called for those crews. And then, even though we had some additional customers we were restoring that night, and we thought we were going to get them up that evening, because of this event conditions of the second storm and the flooding situation, we had to pull our command center. We had to, you know, provide a safe environment for all of our line crews. And at that point, we stopped restoration efforts to protect staff out in the field, and we had to demobilize our command center to go to bring it to higher ground because it was the water that was coming in was extensive on the second storm. Next slide, please. So this is just overall of the main circuits and line affected. This is important, the K line, because that's the transmission, and the K55 is the distribution that feeds the zones. And this is the number of poles that went down. 38 poles were down during the whole event. 34 were on the transmission side, 4 were on the distribution. Next slide. This is just a picture of the North Shore damage. Next slide. And I thought it was, yeah, thank you. And those are just the areas of the impact of where it was locations-wise. Next slide. The increased workforce here is what I mentioned earlier was we knew in the next day, once we were hit by Imperial Valley, we got on with emergency management, and we requested at that point for mutual aid assistance. We requested for 10 additional crews, knowing that we needed to augment the Coachella Valley in addition to the crews that we needed for Imperial Valley, because the assessments were still coming in at the event of the storm. We're system operations, we're seeing various substations come down, and we were looking at the various different circuits throughout. We did not know how impacted the Coachella Valley was. Our staff was assessing, and we're looking, some of them, the members were able to, some of the community was able to be restored in a timely and effective manner. And then we decided that at that point that we needed to augment because and pull back some of the crews that we had up in the Coachella Valley. We brought in EPC, which is Edison Power Contractors, which was 4 crews that were released from the city of LA to help us to keep the workflow that we had already projected. So a total of additional 68 staff out in the field. That doesn't include any of the back personnel than our offices that were supporting from the call center to general services, from electricians that were helping out. But this is just the field crews working on the restoration efforts. And you see there, those are just some of the restoration efforts. And the next slide, some of the work that was done in the location. You have some of the staff there. Next slide. Additional just devastation that occurred in that area. The crews that were doing. This is the circuit map. Early on, our distribution engineering team was looking and assessing what is it we need to do. We knew that the main line feeding this distribution system was not going to be up in 4 days. And once we were hit with a second storm, we said, okay, it's not going to be 4 days. These customers are now potentially going to be impacted up to, you know, as a matter of fact, we just brought up the line today because of the fact that there was additional work and coordination. So what we did was a distribution engineering came up with alternate plans, and you see these little boxes there is where we installed additional poles that was going to be able to, on the distribution side of the system, which are smaller poles and easier to install than some of the larger transmission poles that we have, and find alternate solutions and made the system more resiliency. All of these, what we call shoe flies or additional alternary secondary systems, are the system redundancies, are now in the system. So hopefully it doesn't happen again, but those poles topple down, that now we have alternate feeds, which is why the community, some of them saw restoration as we had at the height of, you know, 900 customers down to 500 customers, down to 300 customers, down to 200 customers. And we were, as we were installing each one of these different engineering solutions to do that. And then of course, just like we installed them, we had to uninstall and be able to then bring back the system to normal conditions at this time. Next slide. We did bring in some generators, and we want to thank the Coachella Valley Water District. They loaned us some generators that were brought in to assist some of the community out there. We were able to provide at the North Shore Fire Department, at the North Shore Yacht Club, and some of the pumping stations. And we knew that one of the residential clusters that received the generation was that they were not going to be able to be brought back in service immediately after we restored the customers, and so they were on generators until today. Next slide. We experienced quite a bit of challenges, and the most challenges was because now the second storm was affected in multiple areas and considerable, you know, devastation that happened in the Imperial Valley. We had over, at the height of the storm, over 9,500 customers that were out of power. And then, of course, the logistics behind and coordinating the 100 plus crews that we have in there. We still maintain COVID-19 safety protocols. And of course, the weather conditions. We want to make sure that the staff that is out there stay hydrated. It's hot, It's making sure that the people that are being brought in that may not be used to the temperatures we experience here in the both valleys that are coming in from the LA area, that they are properly taking their breaks and ensure that we don't have any other type of emergency with the crews. Next slide. So the emergency services coordination started on August 31st and is still ongoing. And by ongoing, I mean that we have the mutual aid coordination. The mutual aid crews, when we knew that we needed to bring this, when we heard of the first 10 distribution call on the second storm, and then we heard that our troubleshooters were calling in impact areas. And then we were at that point, because it was already dark and the conditions we couldn't get through due to the fact that it was not a safe condition for our staff to be assessing, that we were estimating first it was 20 poles, then it was 50 poles, then it was 100 poles. And at one point then they said, okay, we're looking more closer to 120 poles. And then that's when we knew 2 hours, 3 hours into the storm that we needed to ensure that we needed to bring mutual aid into us to help our assistance. This isn't something that we're able to do on our own, because of the fact that we have enough people to create, to, restore and maintain the system. But we brought in 93 linemen and support staff, from outside services to help us. We had, for the North Shore specifically, a total of 12 crews working around the clock. And we started out with 6 crews from Imperial, 6 from the Coachella Valley. The 6 crews stayed there all time, and then we brought in a contract crew to help on there. This is just a timeline of what happened. The North Shore community, we want to thank everybody who was involved. There was a lot of community effort and a lot of community partners that helped with the distribution of food, meals, groceries, bottled water, ice, vouchers, Cool Central. And I was out there a couple of times, and community was asking me where was ice, where was water in flashlights, and we had the distribution there on the North Shore we're providing, and we were also telling them to go to the Cool Centers and providing them. This is just, I won't read everybody, but the list of the partners that were there that provided some sort of assistance throughout the effort. Next slide. This is just a couple of pictures that we have here that we wanted to share. And we want to say thank you all for the understanding. And I'll be happy to add any questions at this time you may have.
Thank you very much, Marilyn. Yes, it looks like we do have questions. Go ahead. Let's start with Indio. Oscar.
Hi. Thank you for the presentation. I was wondering, when you're saying that you're having issues with the volume of resources, can you be a little bit more specific on what those issues were?
There's a numerous amount of, let me explain, when you look at the resources, you look at what is also impacting the United States. So you had major storms that hit other parts of the United States, and so the resources that needed to be deployed to our valley were being deployed to other major things. You had a Hurricane Ida that hit, you had New York, and so typically some of those resources. Materials, in addition, poles that were there. We had some on site, but when we were hit with the replacing of over 140 poles, we needed to do that. A lot of those materials were being deployed to elsewhere into the country. A lot of the other mutual aids, because they had other wildfires and combating different things, that those were the resources that we're doing that we were impacting. We were able to secure and provide for all of the materials, get additional crews, everything in a timely, restorative fashion to provide. And we want to thank the mutual aid crews and our public power partners that also provided assistance, and such as the city of Burbank. We also had APS, Nevada Power, and Edison, Southern California Edison, San Diego Gas and Electric. All of them brought in augmented one crew here, one crew there. And those, all of them, are still on site here in Imperial Valley restoring the system. We lost generation to over 10 geothermal plants, and so that is also impacting the state as a whole, in a sense. We provide power to other customers that are going into the CalISO as well as into other municipalities, and so they are also had to then, at the same time, resources on there. We had the ability to also try and get those generators, and we have restored 3 of the power plants lines that we provide power for them to start producing that generation, that the power, not only for our IID internal services needs, but also that export out of our system.
And so in this process, was there any issues that you saw that we can prepare more for the future, for the next time something like this happens?
This is a force majeure event, a Mother Nature, and this is a perfect example of some of the climate change that we're experiencing. The design conditions that were done maybe 20 years ago are different than today. The wind patterns have changed, and this would be a perfect case study for maybe NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric, would bring in some additional Dopplers to find out what the phenomena on when these storms come in. We've been trying to look at the weather patterns and look at the nearest one is in Palm Springs, so we don't have a lot of them where our system is being hit. Is in very remote isolated systems, and it seems to be on the northern part of the Salton Sea and the southern part of the Salton Sea. Those are the two areas that are there, and it's like a wind tunnel effect. And my understanding from eyewitness accounts is there's little mini microburst twisters that occur, and so those wind patterns that are there is our system. We're improving and trying to provide additional resiliency and to our system to prevent these type of events. All of these poles were tested. They passed intrusive testing. It's just that now we are implementing the more strict and rigorous design parameters based on the known conditions that we have now.
Okay, and then on supplies, do you see us needing to stock more supplies for future events, like bigger supplies, or what do you think about that?
As far as supplies, you know, this type of event, it seems like, we did receive from Costco told us, no, we don't want you to buy any more of our Gatorade and water. We need it for our customers. So we were just going to other kind of areas. So in that aspect of supplies, it wasn't so much of stockpiling. I think our local resources do it. Of course, the level of the magnitude of the event is going to be what your resources that you're going to need to supply to this. I came prior to coming to this area. I came from two coastal regions, and so from hurricane season. And so yes, we notified our customers. We told them, you know, this is a start of hurricane season. You need to have enough supply for a couple of days. We would tell the customers anywhere between 3 to 7 days, and ensure you have enough water, you know, batteries, candles, and provide for yourselves as well. And so those are the community outreach that. Here as community leaders, as part of the Association of Governments, is that in notification and trying to let customers know that these type of events that happen is to prepare where other coastal communities do notify their customers. And maybe if it's something that we have such a good system normally here that we are very not impacted, but in other parts of the country where I've worked, we experienced, you know, 12 storms a season. And of course, the power does go out, and our customers, not that they're saying it's going to go, it depends on what area it happens. But when you see the devastation and the poles being split in two, and not just our power poles, I'm talking regular foliage and awnings being ripped out, it's not as something that you can actually plan and design for.
Gotcha. Thank you.
We can move on. If we can move on, Supervisor Perez, I know that you were out there and helping. And
yeah, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Thank you. And there's a lot to discuss on this issue. And I appreciate the presentation, and I appreciate the questions, Oscar, that you're raising. I think those questions that you're raising are critical when it comes to an emergency response and planning for the future. I got a lot of information to provide, but because of purposes of time, we can't get into it now. But I will say, though, that the infrastructure needs to be worked on.
Yeah.
And we need to come up with a plan of action to make that happen, whatever that looks like. Obviously, the County of Riverside is here to be helpful. We were out there with departments all at once, where IED was able to help. That was great. Where they weren't, we jumped in and we did what we could on many different levels. I'll leave it at that. But I will say, though, that the conversations, the communication is getting better between IID and the County of Riverside. We still have a lot of work to do. And I will say as well that we need those emergency response plans as well as an infrastructure plan moving forward. That's critical right now. And I'm hearing it from our constituents on a daily basis.
Thank you very much. And that's exactly, Supervisor, that's exactly why, you know, I wanted to have somebody here from IID to provide an update on this particular episode, because it really just ties into, you know, the CVEC commission and what we need to and have been discussing as far as needs and collaboration and communication on this could occur weekly. And it's impacting a lot of lives and even being prepared. I think that honestly, they did very fast work given the circumstances But if we had a multiple day storm, we'd be in worse shape, and it could be affecting multiple areas. So I agree, it's a continuing conversation. I felt it was pertinent for this particular committee, especially as we're also in discussions about infrastructure, continued servicing, you know, capabilities going forward, and what our Riverside County cities and unincorporated areas are going to do on a go forward basis, knowing that these things are going to continue to occur unless there's, you know, significant investments made.
Yeah, this is not the first time. It's not the second time. It's not the third time. It's going to happen again.
Correct.
It doesn't matter if it's not going to happen or it's going to happen. No, it's a matter of when.
Yeah.
So the more prepared we are, the better.
Correct. And before I let Marilyn go, there's an Enrique Martinez who also wants to speak. And Enrique, if it's brief, we'll go ahead and have our CVAG hosts unmute you. All right, I see you on the screen. Just need to unmute.
There we go. Thank you. Very quick. I just want to thank the committee here for giving us an opportunity to explain some of the details of this outage. And again, commenting on Supervisor Perez's comments, it is very important that we go ahead and coordinate efforts in regards to these type of situations. Addressing a question about resources, and frankly, this is one of those key issues in regards to being prepared for the worst and hoping for the best. One of the things that we do have is, in our estimate, significant resources in the valley for materials. What we're basically not staffed for is those emergencies. And so we do rely extensively on outside support to bring crews in, and again, it's so dependent upon other utilities being able to provide trained employees that can actually do this kind of work and help us out in these type of events. So again, looking forward to working with the committee here and also the supervisor's office to enhance and streamline our processes in a way that can we be more nimble and also much more prepared for future events. As we have seen in this area, the conditions of weather conditions continue to change drastically. And as Supervisor Perez indicated, this is a number of events that have happened in this area here that have even brought down very strong, well-engineered towers and poles that have happened in the thermal area and moving into this general area of Oasis, Eastern Coachella, and of course the area that we have been serving. So thank you again, and if there are any questions, I'm certainly willing to answer any of those, but thank you again for
thank you, Henry. Right. Thank you, Henry and Marilyn. We'll see you both, I'm sure, at 4 o'clock today.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, all right, we're going to go ahead and move along to the update on our East Valley Electricity Task Force and related items, moving right into power. And Emmanuel, go ahead.
Hi, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Manuel Martinez, Senior Programs Manager. Very quickly, now that I'm here with you on screen, and since the issue of the Salton Sea came up, just want to draw your attention to the Salton Sea Advocacy Letter under information. We sent that last week to the governor and Secretary Crowfoot. The good news is that the $40 million made it into the budget. Trailer bill for natural resources, and those bills are getting voted on this week. Actually, today they're on the agendas for the Assembly and the Senate. So I just want to quickly check that box off and let you know, give you an update there. Getting into my item, this is to provide you an update on the East Valley Electricity Task Force and related actions. As you know, by way of background, very brief, IID and the Coachella Valley Water District entered into an agreement. 1934, it allowed IID to provide power service to the Coachella Valley, and it also addressed the water right issues between Coachella Valley Water District and the Imperial Irrigation District. However, those power lease provisions, which were 99 years in the agreement, are going to expire, posing the question, what happens next after 2033? I'm just trying to stay, make sure the slides, next slide, please. Here we go. Having some technical issue. There we go, thank you. There has been a lot of conversation regarding this issue here at CVAG, most recently related to IID, who established the Coachella Valley Energy Commission. And here at CVAG, the creation of a task force to evaluate the bylaws of the CVEC. And because no big concerns were raised, the task force didn't really get too involved, although a lot of coordination and communication has been happening around this issue. The Coachella Valley Energy Commission is made up of all these member agencies. There's 11. Every city has one. The Cove communities are grouped into three, and there's two at-large members, an urban and a rural at-large member. And at the last IID board meeting, another change was made to the bylaws that allow a tribal nation's at-large member to be added to the committee. The main goals of the Coachella Valley Energy Commission is, again, to address immediate power issues in the Coachella Valley, come up with a strategic plan for continued energy service, and at the same time protecting IID's water rights. The Coachella Valley Energy Commission held its first meeting August 5th at the Coachella Library. Here's a picture, and at a very high level provided an overview of the energy department and its operations. There'll be another meeting this afternoon, as Chair Evans mentioned, at 4 p.m. at the IID boardroom in La Quinta. One of the other things that was established at the first meeting was our meeting calendar for the year. So we'll continue to keep members apprised and make sure that they know where these specific meetings are happening. Legislatively, three bills have been introduced in the last few years. AB 5854, 2629, and most recently this year, AB 1021, all by our representative, Assemblymember Chad Mays. AB 1021, as I mentioned, is the last iteration of a bill trying to address this issue. This bill has introduced, aimed at adding a non-voting board member to the IID Board of Directors, and it required Imperial and Riverside County LAFCOs to conduct a study on voting rights and options for governance for proportional representation for the Coachella Valley. However, most recently, the bill was amended and the non-voting board member was deleted, leaving only the LAFCO study components. On September 2nd, that bill was sent by the legislature to the governor's desk, and it's awaiting his signature. As this issue evolves, CVAG's executive director, in coordination with our Energy and Environment Resources Chairwoman, will convene an ad hoc working group to continue to evaluate the actions and policies of the Coachella Valley Energy Commission. We'll continue to remain engaged in monitoring this issue to keep the committee apprised of this important issue for CVAG. That provides a very high level overview of the task force and related actions, and I'll be happy to take any questions you may have.
Questions for Emmanuel. Really, the intent was to, I see Gina's hand up. Okay. The intent was to kind of revisit our lengthy discussion a couple months ago when this was first passed by IID, and the fact that we have representatives from those impacted areas on the CVEC composition of individuals. But also we had discussed the task force just to review their bylaws. Wasn't really necessary per se, but the goal is to really, I'd like to just continue to work with Tom and have him do the working groups, pseudo task force, to allow us and those impacted cities to be able to have the opportunity to meet and discuss options as this group presents, as IID presents options. We have that opportunity to discuss things on our own as well in a more informal manner. So Gina, go ahead.
Just an idea or a suggestion. Just like the Coachella Valley Water District has five districts and the residents that live in those areas vote on their member that they want to choose in an election, has it been thought to do the same thing for IID and divide it into five districts and let the residents that actually live in IID have a voice and a say.
Emmanuel, that one based on the legislation's out there. Go ahead.
That issue for representation and maybe utilizing that form of governance structure specifically has come up. But at this point, the conversations on understanding what comes next are in the preliminary phases. And so I think eventually maybe those conversations will be had. I don't know if you want to add more to that, Chairwoman.
I would just say the whole point on representation is the fact that their entire board consists of Imperial County board members, and we represent 60% of their customer and revenue base. So I think it's beyond the district discussion. There's a lot bigger issues, but you know, just getting the representation is going to be a huge step in the right direction. And I remain not convinced that another commission is going to provide us that option. Supervisor, I see you wanting to comment without the hand up.
We'll just leave it alone for a bit.
Okay.
let's give this a shot, right?
Yeah.
What's got going on right now. I can appreciate it. I understand Chad's bill became more of a study bill, I guess, to figure out what potentially can happen 10 years from now, which is fine. But I will say that Director Hamby has been working hard. I got to give him credit. He's been working hard to try to figure out how the Coachella Valley can have some sort of, I don't want to say voice. Maybe there is voice, some sort of representation indirectly, potentially. But he is working hard, and he's taking some hits in his own area. So I'll give him some credit, right? And quite frankly, the rest of the board members are agreeing to it. So let's give this a shot and let's see where it takes us. I'll leave it at that.
All right. Thank you. Russell, real quickly. Yeah. You're on mute. Hold on. You're muted.
I want to say, I think committee member Nastandi has the exact idea. It's time for them to go to district by elections. That would, you know, that seems to be the formula that solves the issues that are coming up. So I don't know what they're waiting for. That needs to get done.
Thank you. Okay, Emmanuel, I think we're going to be having you on the next one. It should be brief. If there's any questions regarding the street sweeping study, otherwise we have a recommendation to authorize an agreement. Does anybody have questions or need a verbal report on that?
Madam Chair, can we waive the reading of the staff report and go straight to a vote on this one?
That's what I just.
Motion to approve.
All right. I'll second that, Madam Chair. The only thing I wanted to ask Emmanuel or staff was that do we need to go back to AQMD to see if we could use that extra funding for other purposes? I don't know how much that was. I can't remember. But I know that we have to go back to the board. Is that something of interest that we should look into?
Absolutely. Definitely interested in utilizing some of the leftover resources. So AQMD provided CVAG a grant for $1.1 million to do the street sweeping program over 5 years. And in addition to that grant amount, they allocated $50,000 for the study. The study, however, it came back at a cost of about $26,000. And so we can get the AQMD board to take policy action to allow us to use our remainder money for the street sweeping service. That would be a great benefit.
All right, let's discuss that further offline, I guess, to figure that out.
And right, so motion by Dr. Hot Springs and a second by Supervisor District 4. All those in favor, please say aye. Raise your hands.
Aye.
Any abstentions or opposition? Seeing none, that motion passes unanimously. Thank you very much. And let's go, I'll turn it over to Tom for our final item, which is the election of chair and vice chair for our committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's that time of year again. Your chair is, of course, Mayor Evans. Your vice chair is Councilman Oscar Ortiz of Indio. Any nominations for either of the positions? Is that Gina Nastandi? Are you raising your hand on this item?
I think I'm technically challenged. I nominate the current nominees.
All right, they're not nominees, but I assume by that you mean the current officers?
The current officers,
is there a second?
And I'm trying to lower my hand.
Well, let me ask the question. And I don't know what the process has been in the past, but Oscar is the vice chair. Is it usually that he now becomes the chair?
Or did you
all have a discussion already as to figuring out who wants to be the chair and wants to be the vice chair?
If there's been a discussion, I haven't been involved with it, but there is no usual. Some of our committees change chairs every year. Most of them, the chair is a multi-year arrangement, but it's really the pleasure of the committee. And frankly, I don't know if the chair or the vice chair want to do it again. I presume they do.
I'm happy to do it. I'm happy to change roles if somebody else wants to do it. I would suggest going forward that we probably need to plan on an hour and a half since we've been dealing with issues and we have been going long, and I pride myself on being super efficient, but this is, you know, solid information that we've been covering. So
the mayor could rightfully blame staff on that. It was a full agenda, and we haven't seen you all in a couple months, so we wanted to pack it in.
Yeah, and I'm happy to serve at either capacity. You know, I'm very passionate about our environment here in our communities, but I'm happy to serve up at either capacity on this.
Well, you have a...
And I will second Ms. Standee's vote.
All right. You have a nomination with a first and a second. Any other nominations at this stage?
I'm assuming, Linda, you're okay with your position as well.
Mm-hmm. I am. Thank
all
you.
All right. And if, Oscar, you're okay where you are, then I'm okay with all that, too.
All right. We'll assume there's a motion and a second for the slate. Is there anybody opposed? Then it's unanimously decreed. Thank you for doing it again. Until next year.
Wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Perfect.
Okay, turning back to me then, right? For the wrap up, let's see. Any other public comments that have come through on non-agenda items, Tricia?
None were emailed and I see no hands raised.
Okay, wonderful. We've got obviously some of the updates under the information. Our next meeting is Thursday, November 18th. Seems so far away, but it won't be. It'll be here before we know it. And that'll be at noon virtual as well. And we will try to manage the agenda as well, but we appreciate, and I definitely appreciate the ability for all of you to stay. And sounds like we've got a number of opportunities to connect offline for some follow-up information on some pertinent issues. And if those individuals want to report back under board director comments the next meeting, that would be great. And with that, if there's no other comments, I will entertain a motion to adjourn. And everybody can wave their hand and say yes.
Motion to adjourn.
Okay.
Bye.
Thank you very much, everybody. Appreciate it. Thanks, staff, CVAC.